Before we get to the topic for today, I just, since this could be raised at any time, I'm writing a review for the Jewish Journal of a book called Created Equal. It's about the Bible's political, the way the Bible is politically different from the surrounding cultures. And the one issue that I just wanted to bring up at the moment, which is so interesting and really revolutionary, is the fact that the Bible is a book that you're supposed to know. And by that I mean, you know, in the Middle Ages, actually after the Middle Ages, the invention of the printing press and the fact that people started to read the Bible started the Protestant Reformation. Before that, the Bible was not supposed to be read by people. In the church, the priests were supposed to know the Bible, those who copied it, but not the average guy on the street wasn't supposed to know the Bible. But in the Hebrew Bible, it not only says that people like the king should have a Bible in their home, but it's clearly designed to be read to the public over and over and over again, and the average person is supposed to know the Bible. Because there's a lot of scholarship about literacy, ancient literacy, who could read and who could not read in the ancient world. And usually it was a scribal class that could read, and that's probably true in Israel too, except that there were all these public recitations of the Torah, like on Monday and Thursday mornings, market days. And the whole book tries to argue that the Hebrew Bible was egalitarian, not male-female, but that is all across society, as opposed to other ancient societies, which were much more hierarchical than Israel. That is, kings were had much more power than they did in ancient Israel. There was a political class. There was, you know, because the pagan world had hierarchies among the gods. There was a first god and a second god and a third god. And so down below, they had hierarchies in the pagan court. And I bring all this up because his ultimate argument is that that's why America created an egalitarian society, because it was much more influenced, as we know, by the Hebrew Bible than by the Greek tradition in terms of its religion. Because the Hebrew Bible, the pilgrims, you know, they were all much more versed or much more conversant with the Hebrew Bible than Jews today. That's why many of them spoke Hebrew. That's why the legend, for example, of Yale University is in Hebrew, and why the Exodus was the paradigm, right? That was what they referred to when leaving England, was the idea of the Exodus. So on this day when we are still in the afterglow of the inauguration of a new president, it's worth remembering how much the Bible that we're studying contributed to the formation. He concludes his book by saying, if there was one thing that was self-evident in the ancient world, it was that all men weren't created equal, right? No pagan society believed that all human beings were created equal. The only society that asserted that was Israel, and the only reason that it asserted it was because there was one God, and one God created all people, and therefore, by definition, they all had to be the same, as opposed to many different gods who created differently and had different relationships. Okay, sermon over, study start. Let's go now to chapter 28 in the book of Genesis, verse 10. Okay, 28 verse 10. We're not going to study verse by verse. We've already done this, but just for those of you who weren't here last time, just to sort of run up to what we are studying. Jacob left Beersheba, set out for Haran. He came upon a certain place. Okay, everybody with us? 28:10. He came upon a certain place and stopped there for the night, for the sun had set. Taking one of the stones, he put it under his head, lay down in that place. He had a dream. A stairway was set on the ground, and its top reached the sky, and the angel of God were going up and down on it. We talked about all this in the last two classes. We're not going to go back over it, but we're going to talk about his reaction to the dream. The Lord was standing beside him and said, I'm the Lord, the God of your father Abraham, the God of Isaac. The ground on which you are lying I will assign to you and to your offspring. Your descendants shall be as the dust of the earth. You'll spread out west to the west, to the east, to the north, and to the south. All the families of the earth shall bless themselves by you and your descendants. Remember, I am with you.
I will protect you wherever you go and will bring you back to this land. I will not leave you until I've done what I've promised you. Now, we, again, looked at that fairly carefully, but the overwhelming impression here is that God has some doubts that Jacob is going to believe him, because he's very emphatic, he being God, right? God is very emphatic here. After giving the promise, God returns and says, I'm with you, right? V'hine anochi imach, I am with you. U'shmarticha, and I'll watch you. B'chol asher telech, everywhere you go, every walking you do, literally. And until you return to this land, I will not leave you until I have done everything I've told you. Now, whether he's going to leave him after that is a separate question. But the point is, God's giving Jacob every possible assurance. You couldn't wake up from this dream and said, if only God had been clearer, right? Sometimes God is not clear, but here God is explicit. So Jacob wakes up. All right. First, we talked a little bit about his first reaction, but I wanted to set the stage for his second reaction. The first reaction is, surely God is present in this place and I didn't know it. All right. Again, the surprising part of this is, how does Jacob not know this? He's supposed to believe God is everywhere, but it could be that Jacob hasn't yet gotten up with the program of God being everywhere, or maybe it's just that that Jacob is surprised at the intensity of his experience in this particular place. Maybe he theoretically knows God is everywhere, but that doesn't mean that he's going to have this powerful dream. And it lets us know that it seems that Jacob believes his dream is real, right? You don't necessarily wake up from a dream. I don't know what that is. It sounds like it doesn't sound like anybody's cell phone. So, right. Oh, it's the backup. The lift does that too? Really? Wow. Okay. So it doesn't seem that Jacob has any doubt, but maybe he has a doubt about whether his dream is true, and therefore he says, God's here, I didn't know it. But if Jacob had stopped there, we would have been left with a small problem of how is it that he doesn't know that God's everywhere, and why does he think God's in this place? Does that still suggest? He doesn't wake up and say, oh my, God's everywhere and I didn't know it. He says, God's here. Right. So it still seems as though he's trapped in the idea of a localized God, that he doesn't realize that God's everywhere. But then he says, then it's vayira, which they translate here as shaken, but yira is really awe, right? It's a combination of awe, reverence. Sometimes it's translated as fear, but fear's not really a good... the way that I like to think of this, and the analogy I sometimes give, is in like movies where you have a King Kong or some unbelievable monster, the first moment that someone sees it is actually something other than fear, right? It's, oh my God, it's unbelievable that such a thing could be there. That's yirah. Right? It's absolutely awe-stricken. Now, is there an element of fear? Yes, because how could you see something so unimaginable and not also feel afraid? But predominantly what you feel is you can't believe that such a thing is in the world. So when you have an experience of God, it's yirah in that sense. It's awe, reverence, fear. But when we just say fear, it makes it sound like God's there to scare you. So he has yirah, and he says, man no ra. Now, no ra is the same word as yirah, right? He's awed and says, how awesome. It doesn't work so well in the English. It's a different form of the same word, but you get the idea. Shaken, he says, how awe-inducing is this place? This is nothing but ein zeh ki im beit Elohim. This is nothing but the house of God. Again, speaking about the place as though this is the place where God is. Now, there's a reason why I'm emphasizing this again and again. It's not just to drill it into your head, but it's going to be a possible explanation for what follows. A possible explanation, okay? He says, this is nothing but the house of God. V'zeh shar hashamayim, and this is the gate to heaven. Now, if
and we don't know. But one way of looking about this is if Jacob's ideas of God are undeveloped, if he's young, if he's learned Abraham's lesson, but he hasn't really internalized it, then he really does believe he's in the one place where God is most powerfully and where the gate of heaven is, which is what allowed the angels to go up and down the ladder. So he's found, miraculously, he's found the place that is what, you know, some traditions call the navel of the universe. Right? He's in that one sacred holy place, and he can't believe his good fortune, I suppose. Okay? And then it says he gets up in the morning. Vayeshkem Yaakov Baboker. So all of this, even in some way his reaction, is either a dreaming or a semi-conscious reaction. Okay? And he takes a stone and he put under his head and he sets it up as a pillar and pours oil on it and calls it Beit El. Previously, the name of the city had been Luz. Okay? So, he's created this place and he calls it the house of God. Now, as one commentator says very beautifully, and this is, you know, says, why does he call it the house of God? Because Jacob, running away, knows the importance of home. Which I think is a really beautiful comment, right? He's just left home. He's lost his home. So he doesn't just call it a place of God, but a house of God. Now, here's the part that we're going to spend our time thinking about today. I'm going to offer you a couple of interpretations, and then, of course, we'll take questions and comments. Jacob makes a vow saying, if God remains with me, if he protects me on this journey that I'm making and gives me bread to eat and clothing to wear, and if I return safe to my father's house, the Lord shall be my God. And this stone which I've set up as a pillar shall be God's abode, and all that you give me, I'll set aside a tithe for you. Now the problem is obvious, right? Which is, what chutzpah this guy has. God just promised him. He doesn't believe God, and also he sets up all these conditions about what if God, only if God does this. So, well, I brought you a couple of comments, and then I'm going to offer you my explanation. Not because it's right and they're wrong, but just because it's another explanation.
This is hot.
Thank you. Okay. The first explanation I'm going to offer you is from the absolutely indispensable Nechama Leibovitz. This book, she has studies in Bereishit, studies in Exodus, studies in all five books of the Bible. What she does is Nechama Leibovitz was the leading teacher of Torah in Israel for many years. She's since passed away a few years ago. And she goes through specific issues in the Torah, and she takes you through the classical commentators and how they try to resolve the issue. She doesn't exactly inject her own thoughts. Instead, what she does is she favors those commentators who make the most sense to her. Okay, she was an Orthodox biblical scholar and quite a brilliant woman. Okay, so this is what she says. This is, first she points out that it's the first recorded vow in the Bible, Jacob's vow, okay, which has its own interest. And then she quotes Sifre. What does the text mean, then the Lord shall be my God? Okay, it means that his name should be linked with mine, and nothing unfit should come forth from me from beginning to the end. In other words, the explanation of one rabbinic text is, if all these things happen, then it will give me the strength to be worthy of God. Okay? If God does this and this and this, then I know I can live in such a way that I will be worthy of God's favor. One possibility. Rashi and Rashbam echo the same approach. They both say, and the Lord shall be my God to help me in all my works. In other words, all of this will enable me to be a godly person. That's what Jacob is praying for, right? He's not saying, if you do this, then I'll believe in you. But he's saying, if you do this, then I will be able, through surviving and being strong and so on, to be the kind of person you wish me to be. It could be. No deal is involved. If God wouldn't grant him return to his father's house, how would he be able to erect a temple at the spot, right? When he says, then I'll come back and build a house for you, he's just saying, God, you know, I want to build a house for you. I just want you to know, I don't think I can make it on my own. So if you do all these things for me, I will do that. Similarly, Hannah's vow falls in the same category. Remember when Hannah wants a child, what does she say? If you'll take note of the affliction of your handmaiden and grant me a child, I will give him to the Lord. Right? Same thing, says Leibovitz. It's not so much you better do this or I won't care about you, but in order for me to do what I want to do for you, you are going to have to do this for me or I will be unable. Which is a much more generous reading, shall we say, of Jacob's vow. But still another question may be asked regarding Jacob's vow. Why did Jacob have to say, if God will do this, when all these things had been explicitly promised a moment earlier? Okay? So she says, there are a couple of possibilities from here, but here's the one that I actually want to emphasize for a moment. Rav Chuna says, in the name of Rav Acha, this is from the Talmud, this is from Breishit Rabbah, from the Midrash, really. And it is stated, and behold, I am with me, and then stated, if God will be with me. From here, we may conclude that there is no promise for the righteous in this world. That's a very powerful statement. In other words, he's saying, it doesn't matter what God says to you in a dream. There's no assurance that you will be protected in this world, no matter what God says. That's right. Now, that's a rabbi from the Talmud, right? This is not just some rabbi off the street, if there are rabbis on the street. And this is not the only time the Talmud says this, right? The Talmud says a couple times that there's no reward for mitzvot. Notice he says in this world, right? That doesn't mean all the rabbis assume that there's a reward for the righteous in the next world. That is a universal Talmudic assumption, right? No rabbi, to my knowledge, in the Talmud ever says there's no reward for the righteous in the next world. But many of them say you can't count on a reward for the righteous in this world, and they have lots of evidence, as do we, not only from their own lives and from the people around them, but even from the Torah, right? There are people who live better and have tougher time, and there are people who live worse and have an easier time, and they know that. They read the book of Job. So when he says this, what he's saying is that Jacob is aware of the fact that you can have a dream, but it doesn't mean that you're going to be okay. So he says to God, look, I know you promised this, but I want you to know that if you do it, then I will build a home to you because I'm aware of the fact that nobody gets to count on promises. Now, that also is a little tricky. And what she goes on to explain in different contexts is that, and this is really interesting, that what some rabbis say is, well, if that's true, why does God make all these declarations in the Torah? If you can't count on God's promises, why is God going around promising? And their answer is that public promises can be counted on, but not individual. In other words, God doesn't say to a person, you're going to be protected, and it happens. God will say to Israel, if you observe, you will be returned to the land, and that God will fulfill. But not individual promises, which is why, and in a separate, when Moses comes to, wait, one second, I have this, I may as well, rather than paraphrase and get it wrong. Rather than paraphrase and get it wrong because I can't find it. God comes to Moses, okay? And says to Moses, this is someone who's explaining our passage in light of this other passage, which is what rabbis always do, right? Rabbis and people in marriages. You say this now, but last week you said, right, same thing. So God comes to Moses and tells him to go to the to Pharaoh, okay? And what does Moses say in response? This is Exodus chapter 4, verse 1, but I'll read it to you. But they will not believe me, nor listen to my voice, for they will say, the Lord has not appeared to you. So if they won't believe him, why do they have to say the Lord has not appeared to you? And the Rambam explains we have to distinguish between a public prophecy, those that a prophet is commanded to tell other people, and a private prophecy that God tells the prophet for his own personal knowledge. A public prophecy must come true, for otherwise there'd be no way left in which we can prove a prophecy to be true. Right? That's the only way. But a private prophecy doesn't have to be true because he knows God spoke to him. So Moses is saying, you gave me a private prophecy, they're not going to believe me. And God is saying, because your prophecy will come true, they will believe you. Right? You'll go to Pharaoh, you'll say this, it'll happen, and they'll believe you. But if someone comes to you and says, God spoke to me, you're not obligated to believe them because that's a private prophecy, says Rambam. Which is a very useful thing about when people say, God told me stuff. And in the Jewish tradition, in fact, is indispensable, because if I come to you and I say, God told me you should eat cheeseburgers on Yom Kippur, right? Then you have to have an answer to that, and your answer to that is, we are not obligated to believe God spoke to any individual. Only public prophecies that come true are prophecies where we have to consider that God might have spoken to someone, okay? So that being the case, that's what Jacob is saying, at least in theory. Now, I want to give you one more theory, which is the theory that I advance, but that you will understand could not be advanced by any classical rabbi for reasons that, yeah, that will be clear. Thanks. So, it's good hot. I like hot. So, here's the theory. The theory is, you know, the difference between the way classical Jewish scholars read the Torah and modern scholars read the Torah is that classical Jewish scholars read the Torah through the lens of the rabbis. And what the rabbis assume is true about the biblical characters, that's what the tradition assumes is true. You will often hear the name Rashi, right? Rashi is the most famous biblical commentator. But 70% maybe of what Rashi says is actually applying the relevant passages of the Talmud to the Bible, okay? Rashi, by the way, you may not know this, but Rashi is not only the most famous commentator on the Bible, he is also the most famous commentator on the Talmud, and no one studies the Talmud without Rashi's commentary. No one. First of all, you practically can't, because so much of the stuff is unintelligible until Rashi explains to you what it is they're talking about, okay? So Rashi knew the Talmud intimately and always explains the Bible by the rabbinic comments of the Talmud. Sometimes he'll give a couple of different rabbinic interpretations and he'll tell you which one is the clear meaning as opposed to which one is more fanciful, okay? So because the rabbis see Jacob as a classical Jewish figure, they can't say Jacob doesn't know that God is everywhere. They can't say that because he's Jacob, right? Jacob, like Abraham, like Isaac, he's one of the pillars of the Jewish tradition. And so even though a modern scholar might look at this and say, well, it appears that he's not aware that God is everywhere because he says God's in this place, no classical scholar could say that, okay? But if you open that door, you have now a very different explanation. And I'm sure some modern scholar has said this. I didn't see it anywhere, but I didn't look that extensively. But as soon as you open the possibility that Jacob was not yet aware, he becomes aware, but he's not yet aware that God is everywhere. So then maybe he says, if God will do this for me when I go here, what he's really saying is, if God actually can follow me around to all these places. Because as far as I know, God's here, but I don't actually know if God's where Lavan is. I don't know if God's going to be with me as I travel there. I don't know if God's going to be able to take care of me everywhere I go and bring me back home here. If you are the kind, in other words, what I'm saying is he's doubting God's ability, not God's intentions, right? God's intentions may be good. Jacob doesn't know yet that this is the God who created heaven and earth, and there's nowhere that's outside of his influence or his sway. As far as Jacob knows, this is the place where God exists, and that would make sense in the context of the ancient world, because gods were localized in the ancient world. And when you went to a new country, you prayed to their gods. And the reason that you did was because your god back in, you know, Los Angeles doesn't have any sway in New York. So you pray to the local gods, the local government. It's like the local government in a way, right? So since Jacob doesn't know that there is a federal government, to continue the analogy, or a world government, he continues assuming that God might not follow him, and therefore he says, God, if you in fact do this and this and this, then when I come back here, I want you to know I'll build an altar for you. Now, I'm not saying that that's what's going on in the Bible, but it's interesting to think about it that way too, that Jacob is going through a process of education, that he's going to learn gradually that God is everywhere, even as he will discover at the end of his life, even in Egypt. Right? But he doesn't know that at the beginning of his life because he's been raised in one place with one father and one God, and this is the first time he's out on his own. And even if Isaac said to him 100 times, God is everywhere, this is, you know, the process of leaving home is to some extent the process of discovering for yourself that some of the things that your parents said were true. Really, I mean, you don't know that just because they said it. You don't know that it's true until you discover for yourself and you say, ah, this really is true. Because it's also the process of discovering that some of the things they said are not true for you, at least at that moment in your life, so you have to do both. Okay, let's stop there for the moment. Now we've gotten up to chapter 29 and take questions or comments. Yeah?
Why does Jacob pour oil on the stone?
Okay, what does the word Mashiach mean? Mashiach means anointed. You pour oil on a person to anoint them as a king, and you pour oil on a monument to consecrate it to God. It's, I don't know what it goes back to originally, although maybe someone else does, but that's how you consecrate something, anoint something with oil. It's really mashuach b'shemen, to be anointed with oil. And that's what they did with kings, and that's what the Messiah is, the anointed one. You know, if you've ever seen that phrase, that's what it means. Basically, they get oil poured on their head. I don't know. It's an interesting thing. My guess is Gaster, who was I have his book upstairs. He wrote many, but I have one of his books upstairs, he studied the way in which folk traditions made their way into Judaism, and he studied them in other cultures too. So if you want to know, for example, are there other places that do something like carry a lulav around, Gaster is the place to go. He'll tell you, you know, that in the ancient Near East, there was something like a lulav that was carried by the Akkadians, you know, on alternate Thursdays or whatever. So he might, he would be the place that I would look to find out why, because I don't know why oil is used, but yeah.
What do you say to someone who, they have a loved one who is seriously ill, and they say, God, please, if you save my loved one, I will devote my life to you, just like Hannah did.
So it depends.
And then when the loved one dies, you know, and they lose faith.
It depends. Well, it depends on what stage of the process I'm talking to them. If I'm talking to them at a stage where they can be dispassionate, I tell them that's, you know, that it's perfectly natural to make deals with God, but that's clearly not faith, and that's not what God wants of human beings. Because if all that you want of God is not God's presence, is not a relationship, but stuff, even if that stuff is really important stuff, like health, then as Buber puts it, it's clear to God that you don't want God. What you want is magic.
Jacob is saying,
he does say it, but that doesn't make it right. You ask me what I would say to someone, and I'm telling you what I would say, which is that that's not a relationship with God. What that is, I mean, you wouldn't say that to a friend. To someone who is genuinely your friend, would you say, look, if you loan me the money, I'll still be your friend? No. The proper response to that is, if that's true, then I'm not really your friend in the first place. Right? I might loan you the money, but then I'm not really your friend. If your relationship to God is dependent on what God does for you, then you don't actually have a relationship to God. But if that person said, God, I'm so grateful for the inestimable gift of this person's life. I'm so glad that you gave me this person. I hope that you will continue this person in life, but overwhelmingly my attitude towards you is gratitude that you gave me this person in the first place. That's a prayer. The other one is not a prayer, it's a bargain. And if somebody came to me and said, I just said this prayer, I would not give them this lecture. But if they were saying, as a result, I've lost my faith, I would. That's what I would say. Mm. So. Mm. Yeah?
Do we still have a problem of a localized God with the Mishkan or with the Holy of Holies in the temple?
Well, the rabbis try to get out of that. It's a good question. I mean, what does it mean to build a temple for a God who's everywhere? And the truth is they try to say that God's presence is more powerfully felt. And it depends how liberal you go. But by that I mean the more traditional will say that God is in Israel in a different way, or at the Mishkan in a different way than elsewhere, that God's presence is in some way concentrated in that place. If you move more liberally, they'll say that people can feel it more powerfully in that place. But it's that's why 1,000 sermons have been given about what God says, that you should build me a house, v'shachanti b'tocham, and I will dwell among you. It doesn't say I will dwell in it, but I'll dwell among you, because by the process of building a house for God, Israel brings God into their lives. But yeah, it's a problem. I mean, this was, you know, when Heschel wrote his beautiful, beautiful book that every Jew should read, and it won't take you very long, it's 90 pages, something like that, his book, The Sabbath. And he talks about how the Sabbath is a cathedral in time, right? Because Jews sanctify time. That's what we do, right? Rather than sacred spaces, we have sacred time. After he finished that book, and everyone loved it and thought it was beautiful and wonderful, which it is beautiful and wonderful, and he talked about how technology is a conquest of space. You know, because you can see Obama's being inaugurated in Washington in your living room, which is remarkable, right? And the more technology we have, the more space is conquered. Somebody right now from some Gobi Desert can send you a text message, right? It's just unbelievable. But he says, we fool ourselves into thinking that we've conquered time. But the time of your life, doesn't matter how much space you conquer, the time of your life ticks away the same. That's the essence of his book. When he was done with it, he also received a lot of criticism for exactly this. People said, what about Israel? There is sacred space in Judaism too. What about the temple? So he wrote a book called Israel, an Echo of Eternity, to emphasize the Jewish connection to Israel. But Heschel was caught on sort of the horns of that dilemma. That is there space that is more sacred than other places? So, yeah.
The question is, they're all talking about a space, that God is in this space and that space. How come there's no thinking that God is with me, inside people, not in spaces? Like when he wakes up, he says, I didn't know he was here.
Right.
Instead of saying, I didn't know he was with me.
Even I think when it says with me, people don't think that God is inside them in the Bible. Not so much. They think that God made them, that they're in the image of God, but not that God is inside them. So that's a sort of, to the extent that people talk in that sort of language, it's kind of later development. What they say is that God is close to you, but even the rabbis say, you know, God is as close to a human being as the mouth is to the ear. In other words, when you speak, God hears you, even if you whisper. But they don't so much use the language of God is inside of me, which is, it exists in the Jewish tradition. I don't mean to say this in a dismissive, it's much more New Agey language than it is classical Jewish language. But the rabbis believed that every human being was an image of God, but they didn't talk so much about God being inside them. And I think the reason they didn't is that they were very conscious of not diminishing God or identifying themselves with God. And remember, they lived in an idolatrous culture where the idea of God being inside a human being was real to many people because people were gods, right? The Roman emperors were gods. So I think that they were much more reluctant than we are, where we live in a world, maybe not all over the world, but our world, in which no human being thinks they're a god unless they're crazy. And there is no real idolatry. That is, nobody looks at a statue and actually thinks that it embodies a god. So it's easier for us to speak that way because it doesn't have the same threat that it did to the rabbis. So, yeah.
I'm interested in the stone. He takes the stone specifically from under his head.
Yes.
And puts it on the pillow. Why didn't he just like grab another stone? I mean, what is the significance of this stone? What do they say?
The rabbis talk about, you notice that, well, one second, I'll show you, hold on. It's tricky. Verse 11, if you go back to verse 11, okay? And here's where translation is traitorous. It says, he came upon a certain place and stopped there for the night because the sun had set. It says really the sun had come, but the sun had set, okay? Verse 11. And then in the Hebrew, the yikach me avnei hamakom. Now those of you who speak Hebrew know that that can easily mean from the stones of the place. He took from the stones, me avnei hamakom. Here they translate it as taking one of the stones. But in the Hebrew, it could as easily, in fact, even more easily, if you didn't know what happened later, you would say he took some of the stones of the place. And then later they've all become one stone. So that's why you get this midrash that all the stones combined into one for the honor of being the stone upon which Jacob lay. Right. All the midrashim that sound crazy to you, they're always based on some textual something, right? The rabbis very, very rarely make something up out of whole cloth. And that's why, that's one of the things that certain teachers, like my late teacher Eliezer Slomovic was brilliant at this, and James Kugel does this too, can find in the text, even when I can't imagine, why did they come up with this? They'll find in the text what the trigger was. That's what the Midrash calls it, a garuri, a trigger for why this happens. So according to the rabbis, it was this miraculous stone. It was many stones. It became one stone. And so Jacob knew that it was because later on it says, V'ha even hazot, and this stone, which is singular, but before it was plural. And that's why I told you that there was a nice midrash that all the stones were arguing about which one should be on top. And so they were which one should be the one that Jacob put his head on, so they were miraculously put together into one stone. And this shows you, by the way, how the midrashic process works. Okay, the Bible uses this word, me avnei hamakom, from the stones of the place. 1,000 years later, the rabbis come along and say, why does it say from the stones and then the one stone? Because obviously all these stones wanted the honor, so miraculously they became one stone that Jacob put his head on. Okay? 1,000 years later, a Hasidic rabbi, now no longer the last century, 19th century, said, but even if it combined into one stone, there would still be one on top, right? So how is it that the stones all reconciled to the fact that one stone would be on top? And his answer was, when the Jewish community, which often fights among itself, joins together for one cause, it no longer matters who's on top or who's on bottom. It just matters that they accomplish the cause. Right, which is a nice sort of progression of drashot, of interpretations to make a point, but all that from Avnei HaMakom. Yeah.
Makom, another synonym
for God. Yes. Makom is a synonym for God. In every place that Makom is used, the rabbis will often they'll try to fit God in. And the reason, according to the rabbis, that God is called Makom is that His is the place of the world, but the world is not his place. In other words, he's everywhere, but we're only a small part of that place. But there's no place that is bereft of God. So God is the place. Hamakom is usually the way God. No, makom is place.
Place.
Place, right. Makom is place. You do sometimes, by the way, call God rock, like Rock of Ages. Tzur mishalo achalnu. If you know that song, that tzur means a rock. It's a song that sometimes is sung on Sabbath evening. So, anyway. Okay. Other questions, comments? Yeah. Yeah.
And there might be an implication of referring to Mishkan, where like the Mishkan,
yes,
the holiness is dwelling.
Right. There could be, yes. And in fact, I heard a very nice, as long as you mention it, just because it kicks off a memory, from Rabbi Israel Lau, who was one of the chief rabbis of Israel. I went to a wedding he conducted several years ago, and he, it happened to be the week we were reading that verse, and this is what he said. Remember what Bilam says is, Matovu ohalecha Yaakov, how beautiful are your tents, O Jacob, Mishkanotecha Yisrael, your dwelling places, O Israel. Okay? Now we're in Israel, it's the chief rabbi of Israel. What does he say about that? He says, when it was temporary, when we were only in tents, it's Mishkanotecha Yaakov, it's Jacob's tents. But when we have settled here, when we have built the Mishkan, then it becomes Mishkanotecha Yisrael. So now, he says, we dwell in Israel. And that was what he, which was a very, you know, it was a, yeah, it was lovely. It was absolutely lovely. That's, I don't remember anything else he said. Because, you know, it's like when someone finishes a speech already, you've lost half of it, and then and this was years ago. But I remember that. I thought it was quite beautiful. And of course, you're always, you know, like anybody who has a job, you're always looking for what you can use. So it's true. You read for use. I mean, that's just... that's the reality of it. So, anyway, yeah.
With the vows, at the end, I will call you. Is that the combination of when he changed his name or the last?
He doesn't change his name yet. He doesn't. Well, he doesn't change his name. The angel does. So. So he hasn't returned yet. No, that's before, he's still outside of the land when that happens. He has a lot to go through even after the name change. But it's, I would say it's a crucial step in the process, but he hasn't gone back to Israel yet. He's still, that's when he crosses the Yabok, he crosses the river, but that was last week's sermon. Right. What Jacob says at the end? No, what he says is, the Lord shall be my God, and this stone shall be God's abode, and all that you give me, I'll set aside a tithe for you. That's all he says, right? Yeah.
The presence of God here is in the dream.
Right.
The promises in the dream.
Yep.
But that's different than the promises of everybody else, right?
No. In fact, except for Moses, God always speaks to prophets in dreams. Moses is the only one who gets to speak to God face to face when he's awake.
What about Abraham?
In a dream. Take a look, chapter 15. A deep sleep fell upon him.
Chapter 18, the Lord appeared to him in front of the door in the heat of the day.
Those are three angels, though. That's not God. You see, he looks up and he sees three angels, right? But a prophecy always appears in dreams, at least according to the rabbis, except for Moses, who's the only one who gets to have. Now, God sometimes speaks during the day, but doesn't offer a prophecy like that. And Moses obviously speaks during the day to the people. But at least in theory, Moses is the only one who gets to speak to God face to face. Everything else is more, is at least interpreted by the rabbinic tradition as a dream. Yeah.
It seems to me that the question I have is that these stories seem to me to be telling how the forefathers found and developed the idea of God. And so when we start looking at it, well, how come they didn't already know this? It seems to me that the way it's written,
sometimes yes and sometimes no. For Abraham, that doesn't seem to be true. For Abraham, God comes to him, and Abraham seems to have a fairly comprehensive idea of God, at least at the beginning. Jacob not, but you could certainly, you know, it's all I would say is, without going into any details, your quarrel is basically with the assumptions of the rabbinic tradition, which assumes that they do know. So, but yeah.
If you look at the Akedah through,
right,
that was the way to teach what God wants and what doesn't want.
Maybe. It could be, but Abraham clearly assumes, for example, that God can take Isaac's life if he wants to, which is a pretty sophisticated theological assumption, that God, as the creator of the universe, has a right to dispose of the bits of the universe the way he wants, unless you think it's a crude theological assumption, which could be too. Yeah.
Elevate Jacob, and that he had this extraordinary experience of a direct, some kind of a direct relationship with God.
Yeah.
And I guess my question is that what we're really supposed to take away from this story, that the actual experience and relationship that?
Okay, well, we talked a lot about this in the last class. I don't want to go back over it. But I wouldn't say you're supposed, I don't think there's any single thing that you're supposed to take away from almost any biblical story. But the story of the dream, you got to listen to the last class because that was the subject of the class, was the issue. So I mean, certainly part of it is the centrality of Jacob's experience. Absolutely. But I don't think that you can only take that away and not look at the, you know, at the way he reacts to it. Right. So there are both sides. And again, to go back to the previous comment, it all depends on the assumptions with which you approach it. If you think Jacob is a normal 17-year-old kid in the ancient world, you approach it one way. If you think Jacob is the special chosen lineage of Abraham and therefore has knowledge already infinitely beyond anything that any of us can understand, which is what the rabbis assume, you approach it another way. So I think we're too sophisticated as readers to think that any single approach is actually right. I think that there are infinite, I mean, the Torah has served, you know, there have been so many thousands of interpretations in which people assumed was the only possible one you could really come up with, that by now, even though there are a lot of people who still believe that one way or another, I don't think that that holds much water. So, but certainly, even the rabbis say the Shivim Panim LaTorah, that the Torah has 70 faces. So I don't want to say this is the right way and that's not the right way. I'd like to look to as many different inspiring ones as possible. Yeah. Yes, absolutely. I think that that's very possible, although I must say it's not Jacob's personality, it seems, to feel unworthy, but it certainly is possible. And in fact, let me close by just starting us off in the next, and this will give you a perfect way to conceive of this. Look at the very next verse, chapter 29. Jacob resumed his journey and came to the land of the Easterners. Do you see that? Now, in the Hebrew, it does not say Jacob resumed his journey. What does it say? He lifted his feet. Yes, somebody has a better translation because that's actually what it says. Now, the JPS translation tries to smooth out difficulties in the Hebrew, right? This JPS translation is designed for somebody who wants to actually read the Bible and to sit at home and read it and understand it, but you lose a lot when you smooth out translations, as well as gaining a lot. And when it says he lifted his feet, what does that mean? Now, Leibovitz has a whole long, again, she has, that's one of her issues in here. But I'm going to boil it down to two sides. One side says what it means he lifted his feet is he almost fled from that place. Like he was joyous to go from that place because now he was confident that his future was assured. That's what it means, right? That's what it is to lift your feet. It's now he could run along carefree. He was scared when he got there, but now he's okay. The other one says, what does it mean to have to lift your feet? It means he didn't want to leave. Here was the place where he saw God and he found God and he had this dream and he felt secure and he was frightened to leave. So he had to force himself. He had to lift his feet in order to get out of this place. Now there are two, by the way, both from renowned Jewish commentators. I will tell you, Leibovitz has the whole thing, and she tries to arbitrate which one is which. One from two different Midrashim. In the ordinary way, men are carried along by their feet, whereas this one carried his feet out of his longing for that place he was reluctant to leave. Okay? The other one says, usually a man's feet carries carries him along. Why did Jacob carry his feet? To imply he became light-footed from joy at the Holy One's blessing. And those are two different rabbinic midrashim. So which one is true? My answer would be they're both true. That is, having this experience, it's a human truth that you don't want to leave the place where you've had such a powerful experience. It is also a human truth that if you've received an assurance that takes away a tremendous anxiety, you greet the day very differently than if you don't have that assurance. So to pick one instead of the other would be a shame. And to come to you, if I'd been in my office and I'd say, this one seems the right one, and I'd come to you and only said, what it means he lifted his feet was he was joyous and he left, our study would be impoverished. Yeah.
But also, maybe he moves his feet. It's like, okay, now I'm moving my feet. Let's just not believe
God. If God, right. Exactly. Here I go, God. I'm moving my feet, you know. Let me make sure that everything, yes, exactly. That's entirely possible. That he was very self-kind. That's the way we thought of Abraham, maybe going, okay, God, here goes the knife, you know. All right. See you next week. Thank you.